You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 15th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So Kara is not with us for most of the show. She has a late class.
We'll miss you, Kara.
I had a strange experience this morning. I was driving home from work.
Well, that's a little personal.
Wait, what? Yeah. You said a strange experience this morning driving to work?
No, it was that this afternoon.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, earlier today, but yeah, I get home early in the afternoon most Wednesdays. So it was like 2 o'clock. You get in the car, you're on autopilot of going through my things. The radio comes on automatically because it was on when I shut the car off.
Yep.
And there's some guy talking on the radio about neuroscience, right? So I'm only like half paying attention. And then it starts to sound like really familiar, like the things that the guy is saying. As I start paying closer attention, and it's me.
Yeah. I hate when that happens.
That's nuts. That is nuts.
It was funny. The timing was perfect. So it was NPR, and I must have done the interview months ago. I think it was either early. It was either like right before or right after we went to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot about it. I do these. I just forget about them. I don't keep waiting
as
for
one
them.
Does.
As one does.
So what did your voice sound like before you connected to it?
Yeah, surprisingly, I didn't immediately recognize my own voice.
It's a disassociation. Mm-hmm. You don't expect to hear yourself on the radio. It's not an everyday occurrence, really.
Yeah, and I would say I'm not used to hearing myself, but I am because I listen to our own show all the time.
But the environment. Do you listen to the show in the car?
It was just different voice modulation, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I would recognize myself instantly because I would get nauseated, and that's what would remind me, it must be me speaking.
That terrible feeling in the pit of your gutty what's.
But Steve, you said that you recognized the content before the voice.
Yes, that's right. Because I was talking about near-death experiences and the neuroscientific explanation for so-called near-death experiences. And so, how I use certain turns of phrases over and over, the way I express certain ideas. I just, I don't reinvent the wheel every time I express the same thought. I can't remember what it was. Something I said was like, oh, that guy sounds just like me. Yeah. It is me.
This guy's brilliant.
What a beautiful speaking voice.
Making so much sense.
We'll have conversations worth having.
Nice, Jay.
So, guys, 2019 is officially the second warmest year on record.
Oh, thank goodness for that.
Officially. And the last decade is officially the warmest decade on record.
Oh, boy.
The warmest.
That's all right.
Sadly,
it's been warm before.
So,
we had a 65-degree day the other day, if you guys remember.
Oh,
It hit 70. It hit 70 where I am.
And it, I know I'm not supposed to
enjoy it.
It's more of like
link.
Weather and climate.
But it just reminded me of that guy that says, I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens. That meme?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm not saying it's global warming.
The guy with the hair.
But man, was that global warming? Like 70 degrees in the dead of winter?
It was weird. It was weird.
It was bizarre. I didn't know what to wear. Like, wait, what do I do?
Do you guys ever remember having a day
Never.
That warm in January?
No.
Like 50 years in Connecticut, I don't think I've ever seen a day that warm in Connecticut.
No, we've hit 50s before, but never 70.
Yeah, 50s. 50s is a warm January day.
Yeah,
and it was in the 50s today. It's still sort of bouncing around. It's going to plummet again. And February is probably going to be frigid. But yeah, it's just damn unusual. But even if it's not directly related to global warming, there's just more variability to the weather recently. So guys, we got a lot of shows coming up. We're going to be in Pittsburgh on January 31st, Philadelphia on February 1st, and we'll be doing a private show in Philadelphia on February 1st, and then Brooklyn on February 2nd. And now we added a link to our events page. The link for both the private show and the extravaganza in Seattle, Washington on February 15th. Those links are now also up on our page. Those private shows have been known to sell out, so get there early. And we're going back to the West Coast for our second West Coast extravaganza. Should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I can't wait. I've never been to Seattle.
Yeah, I don't think I have either. I've been to Portland.
Not quite, yep. a little further north, Seattle. I've been there. Mm-hmm. Very lovely city. Plenty to do. Awesome things to see. Don't worry about freezing temperatures. You're not going to experience those.
So go to theskepticsguide.org/events for all the details on all those shows, because it's really way too much information.
And the other thing that's happening is, you know what's coming out next Thursday? Actually, just this coming yes. Thursday for when the show.
Yes.
Airs. Oh, my God.
Picard.
Jean-Luc Picard.
Whoa. The return of Jean-Luc Picard to the television.
This is Thursday, January 23rd.
What have you seen? What have you heard? What's the gossip?
I do know that they're going to have a bunch of people from Next Gen, including Data. Hello,
Squeeze,
who died supposedly back in 2004 Nemesis.
Yeah, but he's a lame-o
robot.
But they're not going to be. It's not going to be a trivial resurrection, though. It's not. They really want to actually, you know, the character died, so I don't know what they're going to do, but it's not going to be. Some Deus Ex Machina. It's going to be something a little bit more.
They're going to take his parts and strap it onto this 20-foot colossus. So he's going to march around. I am Data. Maybe not.
Oh, man. Cannot wait.
Wouldn't it be cool if they used a backup of his mind that was like 10 years in his past or 30 years in his past, so he thinks he's Data from the Next Gen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of possibilities.
The nice thing about artificial intelligence, if that's what we're going to call Data, is that the possibilities are endless. I mean, you could come up with so many plausible reasons and hows and whys that it definitely could make sense. It wouldn't be too much of a stretch. So,
remember, his positronic brain, though, that Sung created, was they couldn't really recreate that. Now, that was back in next gen time.
It's been 30 years.
There's been some time. But, you know, if they could recreate that, then there could be a whole army of – maybe not an army, but a whole – you know, planet of Data's in that case. So I think it'll be something. I think he'll still be singular.
Singular Data?
Yes.
Data. You mean Data, not Data.
Data.
Okay. Well, and if you are interested in our thoughts on the show, the Alpha Quadrant 6 will be reviewing. We'll be reviewing the show. We'll be doing one, I think, after the first episode, we'll do one, and then maybe one or two throughout the season. Definitely one at the end. As well.
Yep.
Yeah.
Should be a lot of fun.
Cool.
I mean, unless it's so unbelievably good that we can't contain our enthusiasm, and then
we'll spill the beans. All right, guys, let's go on to some news items. Bob, tell us about Xenobots.
Yeah, this really caught my attention this week. Researchers have created a new type of hybrid.
Every
you
week.
Guys, like,
every
you
week.
Guys,
if we're starting off real quick with hybrid.
Always pause.
Yeah, the hybrid robotic / biological organism using evolutionary algorithms, stem cells from frogs, and some freaky surgery. So these are from scientists from Tufts University, the Weiss Institute at Harvard, and big shout out to University of Vermont, where my daughter Ashley goes. Woo! University of Vermont.
Yeah.
So this was a research article sorry, Kara, that you're not here, PNAS, a scalable pipeline for designing reconfigurable organisms. This is really, really cool, but the biggest hurdle right now seems to be, what do you call this? Is it a robo-bio construct? Is it a flesh bot? Is it a programmable organism? Is it a xenobot? I don't know. So these are not fleshy C-3POs, by the way. These are basically 1-millimeter-sized blobs created by designed by computer models to move in specific ways using frog heart cells and skin cells. Joshua Bongard is a computer scientist and robotics expert at UVM. He co-led the new research. He said, these are novel living machines. They're neither a traditional robot nor a known species of animal. It's a new class of artifact, a living programmable organism.
Whoa.
So yeah, so this started at the University of Vermont with their aptly named supercomputer called the Deep Green Supercomputer Cluster. Leave it to UVM to call a computer Deep Green.
Vermont is the Green Mountain State, so a lot of things in Vermont have the word green associated with them.
So the computer there runs evolutionary algorithms, which I love. They mimic the survival of the fittest in biological evolution to optimize the performance of digital creatures over many generations towards arbitrary but desirable goals, the goals that these scientists are looking for. So in this case, they coded in their algorithmic virtual space constraints like maximum muscle power. You know, how powerful are these heart muscle cells? and how the joined, you know, conglomeration of cells, how could they potentially move around in a digital liquid environment? So they set all these constraints. So they would take the best performing arrangements of these digital cells, and then they would reproduce them, quote unquote, with other top performing conglomerations of cells over and over and over for many generations, using these evolutionary algorithms. So like real biological evolution, this ends up with organisms that are increasingly tweaked to perform as desired, right? And it all depends on the fitness test. If you're talking about evolutionary algorithms, you're going to probably be talking about the fitness test, because you got to determine, all right, how fit are these things? And then you have to come up with a way to determine how fit are they. And that's like a critical piece of this whole thing, to determine, all right, which ones do we reproduce and which ones do we just delete? So once that was done, then it was time for Meat Space to have a crack at it. And what they did was they took, they used a frog, Xenopus laevis, and Xenopus, that's where they got Xenobot, which is essentially an African clawed frog. So they harvested stem cells, and then they cultured them and turned them into heart and skin cells. So the heart cells were used for locomotion, obviously, because they could contract, and the skin cells were essentially just for the structure surrounding that. So then it was time for a little bit of surgery. So they used forceps, really tiny forceps and electrodes. And the scientists, in a scene that reminded me of the Island of Dr. Moreau, they cut and joined the heart and skin cells into arrangements that were specified by the evolutionary algorithms, right? Those algorithms had the output. This is what you build. This is what you connect together. These types of cells go in this type of particular arrangement. So that's exactly what they did. And I guess kind of surprisingly, these cells merged well together to become what we're now calling these xenobots. Now, these xenobots could move around for days or even weeks. And get this, they could even heal themselves after being cut nearly in half.
What?
So, yeah, they spontaneously heal themselves, something that you probably won't be see C-3PO doing anytime soon. Some tests showed groups of them moving around in circles in a way that they could push small items into like one central area. Some xenobots were created with holes in their centers that could one day potentially they could carry and transport drugs, perhaps. Who knows what they could transport?
You mean over the borders? Like, what do you mean?
The middle of the xenobot had a space that they could potentially use to hold whatever. Like, who knows? Drugs, medicine.
Not taking the drugs like from Mexico to the United States.
No, I don't think that's
Hey, who knows, man? Who knows what you can use this for? Sam Kriegman is a doctoral candidate studying evolutionary robotics at UVM. Said that there's no external control from a remote control or bioelectricity. This is an autonomous agent. It's almost like a wind-up toy. So that's kind of how he described it. So in the future, this kind of technology could potentially help us solve, first of all, some of the many mysteries that remain about cellular communication. We know a lot about it. There's a lot we still don't know exactly what's going on. These robo-organisms could potentially be the key for drug delivery in the body, as I mentioned previously, or you know, greener environmental cleanup techniques, like saying, you know, grabbing marine microplastics and kind of putting them all together and collecting them.
We need a lot of these things
out of the ocean. Yeah. Sure. They could potentially search out radioactive contamination. They could travel in your arteries and scrape out plaque.
Yes.
I mean, I think we have no idea what, you know, all the ways that this could potentially be applied.
So when, Bob?
And when they're done, I'm going to just finish with this one, Jay. And when we're done, the other final benefit that I was able to come across was that when it's over, you don't have these little dead metal robots, you know, floating everywhere. You basically have biological tissue that would just get harmlessly absorbed by whatever environment it's in. You just break down. And so cleanup is not, you know, wouldn't be much of a problem, but, you know, much better than having, you know, hard metal robots, even if they're tiny, floating around wherever. So what the time, Jay, who knows? I mean, I have no idea. This is the infancy of this idea. It's just an interesting technique that goes beyond what we've done in the past, beyond, you know, genetic manipulation of single cells, beyond organoids, which we've talked about in the past. So it's just an interesting angle. And I think this is definitely worthy of some money and some study. Because, I mean, this is just something that could have some very interesting applications. And I think we're just scratching the surface of what these could potentially accomplish. Who knows?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting idea, basically making biological robots. I think, you know, again, if history is any guide, these kind of things, if it's of any use, they'll be some specific niche uses for it.
Sure.
And we're talking like 30 to 50 years kind of order of magnitude. Oh. Maybe a lot longer, but that's like a minimum, at a minimum.
Yeah. One big advance that they're looking forward to is, because right now there's manual steps. Obviously, you have to perform literally surgery on these cells to connect them together. They're talking about potentially automating this entire process soup to nuts. So that would be interesting. Yeah. These conglomerations of cells were, you know, they were small, just a millimeter, but there were still hundreds of cells. Imagine if we could do this, you know, with many thousands of cells. What kind of complex behavior? And then you throw in, who knows, like CRISPR and some sort of genetic manipulation is well on top of it. You know, who knows?
All right. So, Jay, I was flipping through Netflix the other day.
Right.
Yeah. And then I saw Gwyneth Paltrow's vagina.
Wait, what? Which movie?
A stylized version of it. Yeah. So what's going on? Has Paltrow gooped all over Netflix?
Oh! Can't unhear all that.
Right, I'm going to unfold this one so everyone gets a good backstory and understands the bigger picture here. So Goop started a newsletter originally. It started as a newsletter highlighting some of Paltrow's favorite recipes and lifestyle tips. And then the company grew quickly. And then in 2008, Gwyneth Paltrow launched Goop. And now, you know, just over a decade later, on January 24th, the Goop Lab show is going to air on Netflix. And I believe it's a 6-episode show.
Mm-hmm.
They're valued at about $250 million as of 2018. And this company is much bigger and more evasive, I guess would be the right word, than I originally thought. So it's not just the Netflix show and the website. They have a distribution partnership with cosmetic giant Sephora, which is coming up. They have a wellness experience at sea with Celebrity Cruises coming up. You know, I said there's 6-part series on Netflix. Goop also has a ton of stores in major cities in the United States. And they also host wellness summits that cost between, set a number in your head before I tell you, okay, mm-hmm. $1,000 to $2,500 a day.
A day. Wow.
A day. Gee. For one day. So, you know, doing a quick tour on their website for fun and to make yourself feel kind of sick. They sell lots of stuff, lots of stuff. There's a ton of products on this website, way more than I thought. And I hadn't perused Goop in so long that I just completely forgot about everything that I learned the first time. So a few things of note that came out. There's an $84 amethyst crystal infused water bottle that helps you tap into your own intuition. And this is essentially a water bottle that has a crystal in it.
I get it. That's tap water. Gotcha.
Yes, exactly. They have their own brand of vitamins.
Are they shaped like Gwyneth? Like, you know, remember Flintstones?
No, they're not.
Dino and the, no?
Yeah.
Okay.
I see where you're going with that. No, they didn't. They're not. They haven't gone there yet, but that's a brilliant idea.
Okay.
They also have a shitload of vibrators in pastel colors on the website to buy.
Yeah, well.
All different shapes and sizes. They have food. They sell tarot cards, headphones. They even have gold handcuffs. Gold handcuffs. You know, just all of a sudden popped up. Oh, they sell gold handcuffs.
Okay. Huh?
They sell something called a kid calming mist, which is a spray that you spray on your kids.
All I can see, you know, with the cats when they're misbehaving, you grab the water bottle sprayer and you spray your cats. Yeah. What is that? The same thing with the kids when their kids are getting out of hand, you spray the kids?
Yeah, it's like the It's not like the magic spray that you would tell your kids, I'm going to make the bad dreams go away type of thing. I mean, it is literally like they're saying that it has a biological effect, like it does something to them. They have, I thought this was ridiculous, they have romance match sticks, you know, like little matches that are on sticks, you know, like the old school matches in a cardboard box. Goop charges $13 for them, and I found them online for $6, free
Crazy.
Shipping. So, you know, Goop is just marking up the crap out of this stuff. And finally, another thing I saw in there that I didn't like, that of course, they have an oil pulling kit. This is to apparently help you clean your teeth, which is a complete and utter waste of time and oil. So like I said, the name of the Netflix show is Goop Lab, and it's scheduled to air later in the month. And the show promo says it will explore many alternative healing practices, including energy healing, exorcism, and sessions with psychic mediums. So why is this brand booming? That's my question to you, my fellow rogues, and my audience. Why is it booming? And so here's what I've concluded. So first of all, whoever's running this business is great at creating a culture for rich, health-aware women. When Paltrow talked at Harvard Business School,
gosh,
yep, I said that correctly. She said that the drama that comes from news coverage and angry scientists are cultural firestorms, and that she can monetize those eyeballs. And she really summed it up really well. So this is what they do. And this is how the marketing works for a company that doesn't care, that does not care about what's best for people and is not trying to do something good. They're just trying to make money. There is a marketing formula to all of this. So first, you get a celebrity. You have Gwyneth Paltrow. Now, she could use her fame as a platform, which she does and has, and she's using it to sell products. Now, all that the company needs to do is have their celebrity say something ridiculous, make a profound claim, you know, offer a cure, whatever it is. Like in her case, it's all of these things. Then the media will jump on it to make sure that millions of people hear about the ridiculous thing that the famous person said, right? So now experts, scientists, skeptics, who have you, come in and they point out what the famous person did or what they said that was wrong, right? That's part of our job. This often includes doing a public service, like telling people that this product or practice is dangerous, whatever. Don't do this. You know, this is going to, it's not right. It could hurt you. It's, you know, not biologically safe, whatever. So now the famous person doesn't apologize. They double down on their lunacy. And now they get a further boost with publicity because now they're edgy and they're, you know, counterintuitive, whatever, however you want to label this, right? So, you know, they're just continuing to get more media. And it really does prove that even negative media could have a very significant positive twist. So Gwyneth Paltrow says that women feel, now this is like a statement from Goop and Gwyneth Paltrow. Women feel largely ignored when it comes to talking to doctors about how they feel. And they want ways of healing and having autonomy over their own health, love lives, etc. And Goop supplies this. Now, this is patently bullshit. This is complete marketing bullshit. What Goop is doing is taking advantage of people who you could make an argument legitimately are disenfranchised or have had, you know, you think about the history of women in just the United States. Goop is not, you know, representing feminism here. They're spreading misinformation and taking advantage and pretending to represent what's in women's best interest and feminism. But all they're doing is just making a ton of money. It's a $250 million business, guys. It's an amazingly lucrative business, especially when you look at the website and you see the products that they sell. And you also, you know, I've been reading about just like I listed the new deals that the company has. They have this thing on Netflix, you know, and there's a lot of things that can be said about Goop. But there's also a lot of things that could be said about Netflix. I'm very frustrated. You know, I've been frustrated with Goop for a long time. But Goop has been, I think, very, very expertly taken down on the internet. The information is out there. Netflix knows exactly what they're doing. My anger and frustration towards companies like Netflix and Goop is more important than me needing to, you know, I have so many freaking places I'm streaming from now. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, I really don't need Netflix anymore, but I don't want to just do it by myself. You know, I cut the cord a long time ago. I didn't want to be ripped off by cable companies anymore. But with Netflix, like, I would love to mobilize some type of skeptic scientist, you know, mass exodus from Netflix, even if it was just for a few months, to show them, like, when, you know, this is BS. You need to notice that your programming has an effect on our reality. And I'm pissed. I'm really angry about this.
Yeah, I agree. It's disappointing. But unfortunately, like, if you boycotted every outlet, every media outlet that carried pseudoscience,
there'd be no media.
There'd be nothing left.
Pretty much, yeah. It's
like every book publisher publishes nonsense. You know, it's just the way it is. Every network has nonsense on it. Some are worse than others, obviously, and this is a particularly bad, bad example. So yeah, I agree that, you know, there needs to be some way to let Netflix know that, you know, this is not a good thing to do. All right, well, let's move on. Let's make ourselves feel better with a little bit of science, some cool science. You guys have heard about the oldest rock on Earth. Did you read this?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did.
All right, Evan, if you haven't read it, how old do you think the oldest matter on Earth is that we've identified?
Wow. Well, the Earth is what, about 4.5 billion?
4.5
billion. Okay, so you and boy, the early. So you would think it's back from around that age, 4.5 billion. Is it older than that?
The answer is 7.5 billion.
Whoa, how do you get. So some matter's been out there for a long, long time.
So this is stuff. I'm not talking about like atoms, right? We're talking about material. This is the oldest material, like the stuff that you could date, like this material formed in its current form at this time, right? Whoa. Obviously not just like atoms. So this comes from the Murchison meteorite. Do you guys remember the Murchison meteorite?
No, I don't.
We saw it. We saw a piece of it when we were in Australia.
Yes.
Just remember it now.
It's a huge meteorite that fell in that part of the world. It basically pieces of it were all over the place in 1969. So researchers were studying a piece of it using a technique essentially to find out how long different grains, right? They sort of broke it down into like different little pieces, and how long were they exposed to cosmic rays, right? Because if you're out floating out in space, you're being exposed to cosmic rays. And the technique they used was looking for the ratio of the isotope of neon 21.
What about solar rays?
So I don't know, but this specifically is cosmic rays.
Okay.
There are older studies looking at the effect of cosmic rays on the Earth, right? You could look at Earth quartz and you can date it. You could see that, you know, the cosmic rays hitting it over time form a stable isotope of neon 21. The fact that it's stable is important because then we could basically just calculate how much neon 21 there is relative to the surrounding material. And you could say that material must have been exposed to cosmic rays for this many years in order to have accumulated that much neon 21. They basically took a piece of the meteorite, they crushed it down into powder, then they segregated pieces and turned it into kind of a paste, which they said for some reason smells like rotten peanut butter.
Rotten peanut butter?
Yeah. It's
an oxymoron.
Yeah, they dissolved some of the material in acid, leaving only the quote-unquote stardust behind. So this was, again, whatever. This is just a type that they dissolved away some of the meteorite to leave behind the pieces they were interested in, basically. And then these are the pre-solar grains, right? So these are the grains that formed the meteorite in the early solar system. And so they're trying to ask, okay, how old are those grains? Because obviously the solar system formed out of even older dust, right? It formed out of material from previous stars that went supernova or whatever. So we're trying to date not how old, like not when the Murchison meteorite formed, but when the individual grains of dust that made up the meteorite formed, right? That's the difference. And so they're of different ages because they didn't all necessarily have to form at the same time. The ages ranged from the young ones were about 4.6 to 4.9 billion years old. So that's right about when the solar system was forming. Only about 10%. So most of them, 60% of the grains were 4.6 to 4.9 billion years old. About 10% were greater than 5.5 billion years. And the oldest one was 7.5 billion years old. So that grain, that 7.5 billion year old grain from the Murchison meteorite, is the oldest thing that we've dated on the Earth, which is pretty cool.
That is amazing that they can do that.
Yep. It's pre-solar.
Oof. This landed in 1969. The asteroid hit, meteorite hit in 69.
Yeah.
This is weird. So what about before? What about these dust grains and things before the solar system formed? I mean, they must have been hanging out in space for a lot longer than that.
But I guess they had to form at some point out of even older material, right?
Sure.
Yep. And then the clock starts ticking with the exposure to cosmic rays and the formation of the neon 21. So that's the question. When did that clock start ticking?
That's cool. What a cool idea. Yeah. Wow.
Okay. But it's cool that we just saw a piece of that very meteorite just a couple months ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
By coincidence.
I mean, we should do this to other meteorites and see what we get.
Yeah, I'm sure someone will now. All right, Evan, we're going to now turn back to a little bit of pseudoscience. You're going to tell us about the effect of UFOs or UFO reporting on national security.
So guys, UFOs are out, UAPs are in. Yep, UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena, which admittedly is a better description than UFO.
Sure, sure.
It's a, right, but changing the name hardly changes the evidence or lack thereof.
Same aerial thing. Phenomena, flying object.
Right, right. And it's the term the U.S. Navy has adopted. They're trying to shake the stigma that UFO has, well, earned as far as I'm concerned. But nonetheless, it's a stigma. It's carried with the term UFO. But it's been contaminated. It's been compromised. So now we have UAPs. Not a terrible thing. Now, I'll go back to October of 2018. This was at our live show in Cambridge. I covered a news item in which a former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence, that's an impressive sounding title, but not much more than that. In any case, he said, and I quote, "There is sufficient credible evidence of UAP that proves exotic technologies exist that could revolutionize the human experience." He's speaking on behalf of a group of like-minded intelligence community professionals, scientists, engineers, and others. His name is Luis Elizondo. He's no longer an employee of the government. He's now effectively a lobbyist for this group called To the Stars, an Academy of Arts and Science. It's a group of fringe scientists, engineers, and other fantasseurs. Now, Steve, I know you've mentioned him sort of in passing on the show and in blog posts before, because his group, he and his group consider the crown jewel of evidence to be the now famous 2004 Navy pilot UAP encounter.
Mm-hmm.
In November of 2004, several U.S. Navy pilots stationed aboard the USS Nimitz encountered a tic-tac-shaped UFO darting and dashing over the Pacific Ocean in an apparent defiance of the laws of physics. Take that, physics! You are defied.
Mm-hmm. Apparently.
Navy officials dubbed the strange craft an unidentified aerial phenomenon. But they've remained mum on what exactly it could have been. So you can look it up. There's video footage of it, and it's become kind of a, well, popular, more recent UAP, old UFO video that's out there. Mm. When you can understand, this is where the sentiments such as there's sufficient credible evidence UAP proves that exotic technologies exist. You can see where that comes from. Now, the latest news on this saga occurred just the other day when a spokesperson for the Navy's Office of Naval Intelligence responded to a recent Freedom of Information Act request, which here in the United States, groups, individuals are allowed to make, they're called FOIA requests, F-O-I-A, mm-hmm. in which unclassified information or things that are deemed not secrets or anything else can be requested, and you're supposed to get answers on those because, hey, freedom of information, right? Well, they, that is the Navy, confirmed a couple things. The agency possesses several top secret documents and at least one classified video pertaining to the 2004 UAP encounter, and that sharing the information with the public, I quote, would cause exceptionally grave damage to the national security of the United States. And that was as it was originally reported by Vice News. And it gets better. How's this? In November 2019, several naval officers who witnessed the incident aboard the Nimitz had told Popular Mechanics that they had seen a much longer video of the encounter, about 8 to 10 minutes long. The ones you can see online now are shorter than that, so edited footage. The original recordings were promptly collected and erased by unknown individuals who arrived on the ship by helicopter shortly after the incident, said one officer. I mean, talk about throwing the hungry dogs a ton of red meat. This one has conspiracy theorists salivating. I mean, U.S. military, classified videos, top secret documents, unknown individuals arriving by helicopter to take the footage away. This is the kind of stuff that sustains true believers. This is what keeps mm-hmm. their hearts beating, basically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's their bread and butter, man.
No doubt about it. So it certainly is perpetuating the story, and you're going to hear more about this, and you're going to have more fringe people come forward and start demanding that the Navy come clean and release all sorts of stuff. Now there could be tons of legitimate reasons why you would keep this stuff classified, why it would be deemed top secret. You don't have to start going into conspiracy. You don't even have to start going down the conspiracy theory road. But that's all it takes. You know, one statement basically by a communications official, and that's it. It sets off a chain. It can set off a chain reaction. So that's why it made the news this past week.
Yeah, and so that is a very old story. You know, the idea that UFO enthusiasts confuse legitimate national security concerns and procedures with a UFO cover up. Right, that goes back to Roswell. The Roswell incident was covered up because we were spying on the Soviet Union.
Right,
you know, but of course that doesn't matter. You know, to the conspiracy theorists, that just any cover up, they fill in the gaps with whatever they want. It's an unfortunate reality that there's no way around. You know, there needs to be some secret, some national security, and that's always going to be an opening. It's going to be an opening for
for the
conspiracy theorists, not just ufologists, but any kind, you know?
Yep. Those are the margins in which they exist, in which they breathe, in which they hinge everything in their world upon. And they get frankly, they get a lot of mileage out of it. Because they can let their imaginations run totally wild.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's never about the ultimate holy grail truth in a sense, right? You know, because it never is produced. It really is just about these events that take place that are just like this, that give them something to talk about and something to speculate about, you know, because it doesn't ever end up with them saying or having legitimate proof. It's all about the gray areas.
But yeah, but they don't need it. They don't need proof. They just need doubt, right? They just need mystery mongering. The national security basically becomes a blank canvas that they could just paint on whatever they want. All right, let's have a very quick item to finish up the news segment. You guys have heard about planets in the Goldilocks zone for life, right?
Yes, of course. Not too hot, not too cold.
I read an interesting article on Universe Today about Goldilocks stars. Do you know what a Goldilocks star is?
No idea.
Wait, a Goldilocks
star? Couldn't help you.
Star. It's in the... It's in the area of the Milky Way that's less, you know, that's more benign in terms of various factors.
Or is it like a yellow sun itself, like something that could support life? A red dwarf couldn't, you know, would be unlikely, but a yellow sun.
Exactly.
Like ours.
It's about the star, not the location. Okay. So Evan's correct. So what is the Goldilocks star? So what kind of star is most likely to contain planets that have life? And if we could also ask it, you know, if of all the stars out there, which kind will there be, like, will most of the life that does exist, what kind of star would they be around, right? And so here's the variable. As stars get bigger, right, as they go from red to orange to yellow to blue, right, as they get bigger, they get brighter, and that increases the size of their Goldilocks zone, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But those stars have a shorter lifespan. And so that there's therefore fewer of them, right? As the stars get less massive, to be technically correct, they get less massive. They still have a Goldilocks zone, but it shrinks with the star, you know. And there's a lot more of them because those stars survive for even orders of magnitude longer, you know? So
sure.
There's a couple of other aspects to these as well. So for like a yellow sun, like Earth's sun, it puts out a certain amount of X-ray irradiance, right? We'll call that 1X because it's the amount that our sun puts out.
Okay.
And it has a life expectancy of about 10 billion years. If you have a red dwarf, red dwarfs can have a longevity of 100 billion years or longer.
But are they putting out less energy?
And they have Goldilocks zones as well.
They have Goldilocks zones as well, but there's two problems. There's two big problems with the red dwarfs. They put out 400 times the radiation that a yellow sun does. They're also, we talked about before, they're unstable, especially earlier in their life. They can flare, you know. So they would periodically sterilize any planets in the Goldilocks zone, which is not a good thing.
Sterilize.
And also, the Goldilocks zone is so small, so close to the sun, that any planet in the Goldilocks zone is probably tidally locked.
So that's
the problem.
Yeah. Lowers the chances greatly.
Yeah. So red dwarfs, I don't think we could rule out that there might not be conditions that, you know, maybe the planet migrated in until after the sun settled down and it may be just at the limit of the Goldilocks zone and therefore not tidally locked, or maybe it is tidally locked but not completely. You know, you could be like in a resonance like Venus is. Life would have to be able to reform, or the atmosphere gets blown away and then there's no atmosphere, so you're screwed.
Yep.
All right, but in between a yellow sun and a red dwarf, there's orange dwarfs. The orange dwarf can live to be 40 billion years, say something on that range, so longer than our sun, and only has about 25 times the amount of X-ray irradiance, so that's not enough to menace life, and it's stable like a yellow sun, so it won't flare up, and it has a sizable Goldilocks zone that would be outside of the tidally locked zone. And there's about three times as many orange dwarfs in our galaxy than there are yellow suns, right? So our star is a G-type star. The red dwarfs are M-type. The orange dwarfs are K-type. So the K-type stars may be the most in the Goldilocks zone for stars in order to look to find life. That's the bottom line. They're stable. They're long-lived. They don't put out too much radiation. They have a reasonably distanced Goldilocks zone, and there's a lot of them out there. So,
yeah, keep in mind, though, that Goldilocks zone implies, you know, Earth-like life.
Yeah, yes, that it's relatively speaking. Right, exactly. But anyway, never thought about that before.
Yeah, cool.
So that's cool. I mean, I have, but that put it into a new perspective. And you wonder, like, what's the upper limit? Like, you know, stars that live for 2 or 3 billion years, could they, you know, produce complex life? Is that, you know, long enough? But there's probably not going to be as many of them out there because, by definition, because they're not as long-lived. So, and, you know, what is the smallest sun, like the reddest dwarf that could have conditions that are suitable for life? But yes, but in the middle of that range, there's the orange dwarf. That's the K-type star. That's where we're probably finding most of the life out there. Cool.
And don't forget, this also assumes pretty much, I think, because Goldilocks zone implies liquid water on the surface, but that doesn't really take into account subterranean life like we're anticipating on Europa and Enceladus. So that's another angle you got to consider that's separate from what they're really talking about.
Or moons of Jovian planets.
Yep.
I wonder what the Earth would look like lit by an orange sun.
Yeah. But of course, what would the eyes of the creatures that evolve on that planet
be
like?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Or whatever it is.
All right, Jay, get us up to speed on Who's That Noisy.
Oh, my God. Yes, I will. All right, guys, last week I played this noisy.
Wow.
Okay.
Let's see here. Visto Tutti wrote in and said, I think I hear some stepper motor action and then some laser cutter. So I'm saying this noisy is a CNC laser cutter in action on some sheet metal. That is not correct, although I thought that was a really fun
That's a very sophisticated wrong guess. Yeah.
Alex Moore wrote in and said, hi, Jay. First noisy I know for certain. This is a repair droid orgy, possibly taking place in the Jawa Sandcrawler on Tatooine.
Yep, that's...
Looking forward to the next noisy. that is not correct, but you reminded me of some cool Star Wars trivia I have picked up recently.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Star Wars porn.
No. The Jawa Sandcrawlers, they did not build those.
No?
Those were reclaimed. Nope.
Whoa.
Reclaimed.
Well, that kind of makes sense.
It makes sense, doesn't it?
It does make sense. You know, Jawas are like scavengers. They take things and repurpose them.
Caleb Kramer wrote in, hello, I'm going to start the year off right by attempting a guess at every Who's That Noisy. I love it when people say that because after 3 or 4 months, they're like, man, I can't get anything right. Because it is hard. I admit, this is a hard segment. But Caleb, please do that. I'd really appreciate it. He said, it sounds like a microphone recording a digital signal. My initial thought is to say it's some sort of FM synthesis like the Citrus synth, but it sounds too complex for that. I'll guess it's some slowed down transformer sounds. This is mostly what I would consider to be correct. So here is the actual answer. there's a tool that they're using that can detect magnetic waves from electronic devices and converts them into audio frequencies so you can hear what's going on, right? So the website doesn't say how the conversion is done, but we're guessing that they transpose the frequencies down to multiple octaves so you can hear them all. You know what I mean? Because if the spectrum was as big as the way that we hear sound, the octaves would be out of our ability to hear. So they're crunching down everything so it's in hearable octaves. So what you end up seeing here is that they're holding a device, which is the reader, against all different sorts of electronic machines. So this is a mashup of all these different sounds that they've collected. But it's really interesting to see like noises coming out of different parts of, say, an Xbox. You know, where the DVD that you put in the Xbox is spinning up, this thing will read a certain noise out of it. And then, you know, other places inside that have devices are going to be transmitting different sounds. So very, very cool. I'll give Steve the link. You're really going to like it. Now, on to the new Noisy for this week. The new Noisy was sent in by David Morrison Weigel, W-E-I-G-L. And here it is.
Okay.
What the hell was that?
French person.
I love this segment. I love this segment so much. It's so random.
It's either a turtle having sex or a computer trying to work out syllables.
I think that what you should do to show your love and respect is send me a guess. Send me a guess. What was that that you just heard? You could send that to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. All right, so just a quick email. Actually, we got about 3 million emails on this question, right, Evan?
I stopped counting at a million.
At a million. So Evan incorrectly said that Wales is in England, and the entire population of Wales emailed us to correct that, which we appreciate it. Now, I do want to point out a couple of things. One is that even though we're dumb Americans, we do know this, right? We do understand that the United Kingdom is England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland, right?
Absolutely.
And that England is just one, you know, I've heard some sources call it a principality, others call it a nation, whatever, but the country is the United Kingdom. Yeah, we understand that. This is admittedly, it's not stupidity, it's just laziness and sloppiness on the part of Americans.
Hey.
It's true. I mean, we use the term we often will refer to England
as Great Britain, you know,
just
and vice
lazily
versa.
when we know we mean Great Britain. And I'm not sure why that's one of the ones that we have sort of stuck in our head. It might be I liken it to, you guys remember back when there was a Soviet Union, and we would refer to it often as Russia.
Yes.
Even though we knew that it wasn't Russia, that it was the Soviet Union. So, but that was sort of the thing. We called the Soviet Union Russia, and we called the UK England. You know, that was how we grew up. So even it's that sort of old, you know, sloppy, imprecise way of referring to it. It just stuck in our heads. We make that substitute. We basically use the term UK and England interchangeably, you know, in our head.
Right.
Plus, which we know is wrong and we shouldn't do, but that's just an old habit. It's just an old habit.
And you're assuming we were all paying attention at that exact moment.
I'm saying we weren't really paying close enough attention. It didn't trigger anything.
I will say that I think the chances of me repeating this mistake are much lower now and going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. We will try to be absolutely vigilant about it because we know that we have an international audience. And first of all, we want to be correct and we want to be precise. We want to make mistakes like that. It's hard, though. You know, you're chatting for an hour and a half to be vigilant about every single word you say. And we have multiple layers in here. You know, we keep each other honest. There's post-production. But when this one slipped through, you know, all of the filters, that's the explanation I'm giving for it, because it's one of those things that just doesn't trigger much in our heads. But we promise we will try to be more vigilant about it because we don't want to inadvertently offend our international listeners, and we certainly don't want to sound ignorant of of geography outside the United States.
I'm very good at geography normally. If it was a...
No, it's like it's what's frustrating. It's like, of course we know that, you know. It's not, you know, I think most of the emailers assumed like we didn't know that, like we weren't aware of it.
Right.
So, but keeping us honest, I dare say we learn as much from our listeners as our listeners learn from us. And that's one of the surprising and cool things about the show is the crowdsourcing.
You know?
As we like to say, like we, no matter what we talk about, somebody listening to the show is a world expert on that thing. You know, they did their thesis on it or whatever.
Right, so no matter how granular we get on certain topics.
Yeah, right. No, it's cool. It's one of the fun aspects of doing the show.
Absolutely. It's a learning experience.
We are joined now by Joseph Carvalco. Joe, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, thanks a lot, guys.
And Joe, you're on the show because we wanted to talk about your latest book and perhaps other things that you've done and written. But the title of your latest book is Conserving Humanity at the Dawn of Post-Human Technology. So why don't you start off by telling us how you define post-human technology?
Post-human technology is what I think, will be sort of an evolutionary, perhaps in a gradual way, change to whom we are anatomically and I think cognitively. And we can talk about, you know, as we get into this, how I sort of, you know, what I see as the parameters and the limitations, in that short definition.
Okay, so it's basically altering, if we alter ourselves enough anatomically or cognitively, you would consider that post-human.
Correct. That's right.
But yeah, there's never any sharp demarcation line to something like that. Like, we joke about the fact, like, if you have a knee replacement, are you a cyborg? Yeah, well, technically, yeah. I don't think most people would consider that. So where would you draw the fuzzy line? Like, what kind of alterations do you say, yeah, that's definitely over the line to something that is different enough that we would call it post-human?
Let me just begin by saying this. I think what I'm driving at in my book here is that there'll come a time when there's a fundamental change in terms of our core, our essence, which isn't necessarily an anatomical thing. It may be cognitive or psychological, but there will come a time, when we don't think and feel the way our species thinks and feels about things as they do today. There'll be a demark. There'll come a time when whoever they are, look back and say they were different from us.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, for instance, I take your point. I've got a pacemaker. I'm not a cyborg. All right. It doesn't make me think any differently than I thought before I had it put in. Last year, where there were twins that were genetically modified, China. Mm-hmm. You know, it's doubtful, that those twins will grow up feeling cognitively any different from you or I. There was a change, I guess, in a particular gene is a CCR5 or CC5, and presumably there's some talk about whether or not that will have any effect on some cognitive element or aspect of their some element of their cognition. Will it make them more intelligent or whatever? I don't know if changing one gene is going to do anything, but there may come a time when sufficient number of things are altered, so that there will be a change in the manner in which people are decidedly more have a higher IQ, or at least have G factors that are different, from what we see now in the general population.
Joe, what's a G factor?
Right, what I'm talking about are the IQ element, the things that lead up to what would be a general IQ. All right, so spatial, visuospatial type, or working memory. Other facets, of the brain, or the cognition that would seem to be affected, by changing, altering, a sufficient gene set.
Sure. Yeah. Even beyond genetic manipulation, it could be just some sort of melding with technology, as well. And so there could be different, very different pathways to, you know, to that point where we are significantly different. Sure. Yeah. It's going to be a fun time when that happens.
Won't there be a chorus of people perhaps equally as passionate to keep this from happening in a sense that it's not natural or it's for religious purposes or what have you, that they're going to try to fight back against this or lobby their congresspeople to outlaw or make laws against these sorts of technological advancements? Won't there be a backlash? Isn't that also sort of also part of the prediction?
It is. And in fact, you know, I actually, in the book, I have a particular, you know, a chapter where I talk about right now that there's no consensus has been forthcoming, you know, among scientists. But in March of 2019, which is only last year, 18 scientists and ethicists from 7 countries called for an international governance or framework to put in place so that we could, you know, establish some body or some consensus as to whether or not, you know, we want to go ahead with this thing. The New England Journal of Medicine published 2 articles strongly favoring germline editing in this regard.
Huh.
So you have this Dieter Egli at Columbia University, who's experimenting with gene editing human embryos for research purposes, and this Werner Neuhauser, and both of them, and he's at Harvard, incidentally. They're pretty much against any sort of restrictions. They're looking to go full force and ahead up in this particular area. Yeah, I've attended a couple of international conferences run by the National Institutes of Health and NAS and the Royal Academy this past year, and of course they haven't come to any conclusion. But my tendency is to believe that eventually they're going to try to put the brakes on a lot of this until we have a better appreciation as to just exactly what we're messing with.
Well, certainly the germline editing is the most serious, I think, because it has the potential of getting genetic changes into the human population, as opposed to somatic editing, which will end with that person.
Right.
I think that'll happen a lot sooner. Yeah, you know, because whatever happens, it's informed consent, as long as, you know, I think the standard will be a lot more lenient for that. And of course, the other technology entirely, as Bob brought up, is brain-machine interface. You know, I think that might have a more profound effect, not just tweaking and perfecting the biological human brain. You know, we're building artificially intelligent computers that will then interface seamlessly with the human brain and augment it in ways that are a lot more unbounded, you know. So that, I think, has a as you say, the potential to change our cognition, I think, beyond recognition from what we have now.
I think there's really 3 options, though. You know, you have the people who augment their minds and intelligence genetically, and then you have the melding, Steve, with technology. But then the other end of the spectrum, of course, is the purely mechanistic, you know, artificial intelligent, you know, computers. And I think that could potentially just swamp all the other 2.
But Bob, there's a 4th option.
Yes, and that extraterrestrial intelligence.
No, I was thinking of the spice. But by which I mean a completely unanticipated technology, right?
Sure,
something
absolutely.
May happen that we don't even know to put on our list at this point in time. But I think, yeah,
oh boy.
If for the foreseeable future, realistically, it's, I think, you, yeah, those are the 3. But if we're talking about changes to humans specifically, then it's, you know, machine, brain-machine interface and
right.
genetic
sure.
manipulation are the 2, right?
Yep.
And I agree with that entirely. In fact, I wrote a paper that I gave at Tufts in November, which is exactly on this point that you're making, that there may be a confluence of 2 technologies. One is the silico technology, or the transistor technology, for the lack of a better word, and the genetic technology at the same time. However, you know, as an engineer for many years, one of the more difficult problems that we constantly face, and I'm sure you face this in medicine as well, it's the interface problem. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's getting something like concrete chemicals and plastics, okay, to basically work in the body. You know, it took them years in order to get the pacemaker to work well, so they weren't, you know, burning people's hearts out.
Uh-huh.
Ouch. Trying to get it to work, and so that's a big problem. However, you know, what we are seeing is that synthetic biology, you know, synthetic biology is beginning to ramp up to the point where they're actually beginning to make, at least in, you know, in a Petri dish and beyond that, actually, the analogs to all of the computer components that I used to use when I was architecting computers way back when. All right. Mm-hmm. So I was involved in designing parallel processors some point in my life. You know, so I'm very fully familiar with transistor logic and microprocessors and all that jazz. But now what they've done, there's a patent that came out in 2017, and what it does, it essentially within the constructs of a biological cell has created an analog to digital converter and an analog to digital converter and a digital to analog converter. All right, I mean that is the one of the basic foundations, okay, for input output. All right. So if you're going into something, you need an analog to digital converter. And if you're going back to it, you know, back to the other side, you need a digital to analog. All right. To get into, you know, your sensory system, for instance. So that particular invention is already on, you know, is a thing at this point.
Would that be at the cellular level?
Yes.
Wow.
Yep. Iwa was right. Right. So they're providing digital to analog conversion. And is represented by a bank of switches in binary format. Each switch drives a transcriptional promoter of differing lengths, with the switch representing the least significant bit during a promoter of least strength, and the switch representing the most significant bit during a promoter of the greatest strength.
I wonder how that would work, Steve. I mean, would you need to connect? You would need to connect them to. I mean, you couldn't just do one, like say, neuron. I mean, you'd have to do like many, many thousands. Before you'd have any meaningful kind of interface, like say to the human brain. And so that sounds like the definite sticking point. I'm sure there's many sticking points for that, but it's still a fascinating advance.
Yeah, but I wonder if it's even necessary because, you know, we can read the electromagnetic activity in the brain that correlates with the firing of networks in the brain and then interpret that, you know.
How granular is that?
That's the issue, yeah. It's granular enough that somebody can control a robotic arm, you know, with their thoughts. But let's turn a little bit to the other aspect of your book, which is interesting, is not just the technology of how we're going to get to this post-human state, but what do we do when we get there, basically? And specifically, how do we keep a connection to our humanity when we're walking around with supercomputers on our heads, you know? So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's the, for me anyway, it's probably the more interesting part because there's a lot of folks writing on the STEM part of this thing, right? The yeah. Science, technology, engineering, math stuff. But I like to turn my attention to what I call LAMP, L-A-M-P, right? And that's my acronym for literature, art, music, and philosophy, right? All right. So we need both STEM and we need LAMP. All right. And so for the first half of the book, it is the technology, because I honestly think that for people to be informed, they have to know something about, you know, what is it that's going to cause this change that we're anticipating undergoing. But then for the second part of the book, really, I turn my attention more to, you know, how is it that we need to keep our eye on with regards to who we are. All right. And I call it my essence, but that's a word that's been around for centuries, right? I mean, Spinoza talked about it. Kant talked about it, and Sartre. And there's a lot of philosophers that talk about human essence. But I come at it from the point of view that one thing that defines humans, it defines us, I think, is our ability to create. So in addition to the fact that we have this intelligence, okay, which, and we put it to some use, there's something else that's going on, and that's in terms of our ability to create things out of whole cloth that robots, I don't think, can do. I do think in enhanced human beings will have a different creative capacity. And what do we mean by, you know, what kinds of creations can we sort of anticipate, right, go, you know, happening, okay, let me back up a minute. My book covers, you know, two angles. One is the angle where we will live in a post-human technology society. Okay, where human beings are being augmented in some fashion, but I also cover a considerable amount of artificial intelligence as well. All right, and so so I think that, you know, when it comes to the future, we have to look at both sides of, you know, both elements, because eventually, as we've been talking here, both things may become a factor in the human anatomy, right? Artificial intelligence through devices, okay, that interface with the brain, and also the genetic piece of it, okay, that's going to augment our genome. What is that makes us distinct, I guess, from other creatures on Earth? And one of it, and it is our creative capacity. So we are storytellers. Let's start there. All right. And I speak to what it is that, for instance, AI is capable of doing with respect to storytelling, and what it's not capable of doing. What is it capable of doing with respect to the creation of music, and what it's not capable of doing? And then I carry that through, you know, music. I carry it through the idea of storytelling. I carry it through the idea of just raw creativity with respect to inventions, you know, coming up with something that's novel, that's useful, and how it is that others, certainly AI, for instance, is not really good at that stuff. The human brain has to impose itself when it uses AI in order to create something. And so, for instance, if we're trying to create a motif that's in the style of a Mozart motif, for instance, there are computer programs that do pretty well, to the point where it's hard for even an expert sometimes to basically know the difference between, let's say, Mozart or Chopin and what the computer is doing. The difference is that the computer is just regurgitating a whole bunch of licks, right, that Mozart or Chopin did, in a way which sounds melodic, because they've got the right either evolutionary algorithms working, genetic algorithms, or they've got the right other, you know, algorithms working. And it makes it sound okay, but there isn't a computer, okay, that will just sua sponte or you know, on its own, go ahead and create something like a Mozart.
Well, I think the other thing, angle I would put on that is, so far, every time people have said that some task is too complicated or too difficult for AI, AI has eventually accomplished that task. So if, you know, history is any guide, I think it may seem that, yeah, looking at our existing computers, like, might seem like an impossible task to duplicate the algorithms necessary for abstract artistic creativity. But that's just another problem to be cracked. And I think that, you know, we'll probably get there quicker than we think.
Oh, really?
To be honest with you. Yeah, even because I don't think we need, like, sentient, self-aware AI to do that. It's going to be like, yeah, you know, we have computers that, you know, can beat the best chess champion. They didn't think that a computer would be able to do that. It seems like it takes too much thinking, but it really is just a matter of, you know, the proper algorithms. And then it was Go, you know, and then of course we had, you know, deep learning, et cetera, as a new approach to it, broke us through any previous limits. And now, of course, we're at sort of at the dawn of quantum computing. I don't even know if it's applicable to any of this, but who knows what ultimately effect that is going to have.
Right. And then another completely different angle, Steve, is to another approach to artificial intelligence is to digitize a human mind and recreate it in, you know, digitally, and then just soup it up. I mean, if you could basically run a mind, you know, in the computer that's a duplicate of a human, and then just, like, overclock it, you know, make it a million times faster. I mean, that's in a sense, that's an artificial intelligence. It's not, you know, electrochemical.
Yeah, we don't necessarily have to, like, duplicate an entire human brain.
No, not right.
We've already modeled, for example, a cortical column, which is the fundamental unit of cortical organization. And let's say we make a cortical column. That's something that we can do now. And then we say, okay, let's just make a billion of them, you know, or a trillion of them or whatever. And you use some kind of a deep learning evolutionary algorithm, whatever, to just have those, you know, billions, trillions of cortical columns start to conquer tasks, to do things. And then before you know it, they're writing operas. You know what I mean? I think that's the kind of thing where we can't predict that. It's way too, you know, I would be very reluctant to say that there's anything that, you know, artificial intelligence won't be able to eventually do.
Well, there's a, you know, I guess time will tell.
Yes.
I guess my whole mindset in, you know, making the point is that there are things like, let's say, Einstein's theory of relativity, right, that came out of nowhere, right? Mm-hmm. Or not quite out of nowhere, but or his theory of gravity, for instance. And the question is whether a computer will have the mind, or at least have the ability to conjecture. And I think, you know, when we delve into those human qualities of conjecture, of doubt, it's different, okay, from computation. And it's even different from learning. So, for instance, you know, I worked on learning machines for a long time, and a neural networks as well. I've got many patents in that area. And they're capable of adapting, right? And so they see a pattern out there, right? And they're capable of appreciating what the pattern is, and then beginning to put themselves into the mode of being predictive in what they see and what they sense. But that's different, okay, from, I think it's a different quality than, the ideas of, as they say, conjecture, or just, you know, coming up whole cloth with something, the wow moment, okay, that a computer can't, I don't think, right now at least, I can't imagine how the computer actually gets to that mode. It's almost like, you know, you ask a person who has no sight to paint a self-portrait. Mm. Right, they can't do that. Right, it's just they don't have a motive of doing that. Right, so there are some things that are outside the ken or the ability of something to do because it just doesn't have the feature that's necessary in order to achieve anything in respect of, let's say, that form of creativity. And again, a blind person painting their portrait is the one example I could think of off the top of my head. I've got others in the book that I speak to.
Yeah, but to push back on that a little bit, though, I think that the unstated major premise there is that a computer would have to accomplish the task in the same way that a human does, and that it would have to experience, you know, its own sort of wonder or have its own sort of wow moment in order to have the output that a human does. But I think that what we're learning is that with artificial intelligence, it could accomplish the same tasks without that, just in a completely different way, in a computer way, you know, in an artificial intelligence way. And that is why I think all of our projections have been grossly underestimated what AI will be capable of doing, because we had this false assumption that it's got to do it in the way that humans do it. And because computers aren't able to mimic certain aspects of human cognition, that therefore it won't be able to do it for the foreseeable future. But then computer science is like, nope, we could just do it this other way. You know, whatever. We'll get around that. We'll just accomplish it in a completely, you know, different process. But the end result, it'll still beat the best, the world's champ at Go, you know, even though it doesn't know that it's doing that or whatever. But it's complicated, you know, it's to think about. And of course, we don't know how it's going to play out. That's like one of the most fascinating things is watching this play itself out.
You know,
we've been doing this for a long time. And again, so far, it's pretty much exceeding expectations. Not the science fiction expectations of like the 1950s, but, you know, when you're talking about like serious, knowledgeable projections about like what kind of tasks will AI stumble on. And yeah, well, so far, they've been kicking their ass.
It's definitely been a slower process than first anticipated. I mean, what they call it, was it in the 60s or 70s, the AI winter, because lots of research ended. Because, you know, there was so much hype that was never met that people became discouraged.
Yeah, that's true of every technology.
Right.
It's not really a knock, because that's just that every technology goes through the premature hype phase and then the post-hype disappointment phase. But if you ignore that and you just look at the arc of meanwhile, in the background, it's progressing nicely. But I do want to turn to that, you know, just to finish this up, to that one point that you were making, Joe, about that regardless of what AI is capable of doing, it was kind of got lost on a tangent here. The fact is that you know, we are going to be altering ourselves through genetic manipulation and merging with our AI to such an extent that you feel that we need, you know, the arts essentially to hold on to our humanity. But my question for you is, what if we don't care? You know, we think that our future selves will, you know, should hold on to humanity, but they may not give a shit. And it's kind of thing like when you look, as you look back, it's almost kind of like your child self thinking about what your adult self might want to do. And then when you get to be an adult, you realize that whatever your child self thought was irrelevant, right? Because you were just a child.
Yeah, but then you also got to think, Steve, that when were you truly happy? When you were a child.
Nice, Jay.
When you didn't know too much.
But you could never go back to that, right? We've talked about this. You could never regain that childlike wonder or magic again because you're not a child. You know, you can't. The best you could do is to enjoy it vicariously through your own children or through other children. But you can't really recapture that. And so you don't try. You have to appreciate the world as an adult. And so I think that the post-humans will kind of look amusingly at our concern, you know, whether they're quote unquote connected to their humanity. I don't think they'll care. You know, they'll say we are what we are. And who are you to tell us, you know, that we have to remain connected to some kind of historical limitation that we don't care about anymore. What do you think about that, Joe?
And I've done it in other books as well, but this one in particular, I emphasize this. I have a science fiction that runs with the book. In other words,
oh, cool.
Every so many chapters, then you revert back to the science fiction, and it's a conversation between two people in the future, you know, 200 years into the future, Mensa and Saruk. Mensa was born about now in our age. She was genetically modified over the course of time, and she was provided AI computers and the like. So she ends up living 150 or 200 years. Her counterpart that she's in this conversation with, he is a product of the future. And they have this conversation which goes throughout the book, and there must be like 10 chapters, I think, a couple of pages each.
Cool, I like it.
But it goes through this whole idea where he could care less. He's satisfied with where he is. He never knew what it was like once. And she says, you know, well, you know, I'm from another world, essentially. And although I can see the advantages and the benefits of, you know, what we've become, I can still remember, you know, another time. And she says something like this. She says, Saruk says, is there something innate in our being beyond the biological that keeps us evolving? And she says, yes, I think there is, but merely evolving into another techno creature or form has in and of itself proved that the entity we once regarded as human lost the battle against its extinction. Mm-hmm. Saruk says, how so? And Mensa says, Mr. Saruk, we have severed the modern world from all that preceded it as if it never existed. We live in a culture that fractured into a million unrecoverable shards. Gone are the traditions and common wisdom. The ethos into which I was born exposed me to beliefs, values, and needs. I once aspired to leave at least a ripple of myself on the wake of greater humanity. I aspired to love. In this process of living at its fullest, our forebears brought to bear an inseparable blend of intention, feeling, judging, morality concerning what they did. Today's post-human worships technical progress, not tradition. Common wisdom's been replaced by a world order of interconnected, internalized technology. So it's to your point, right?
Yeah.
It's to your point. That there will come a time in the future when they look back and they could care less. I could care less about how people live in the 1500s.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Well, Joe, the book looks like a fascinating read. I haven't really gotten through it yet myself, but I've read a bit of it, and it's very interesting. As you could tell, we love to talk about these topics. they're endlessly fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it, and the conversation was really engaging. Thanks again.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Joe.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is, you ready for this? Geography.
Hey!
No? Oh, God, of
the
course.
The answer is Great Britain.
The answer is Wales.
All right, so here we go. Three surprising facts about world geography. We'll see how well you guys have a mental map of the world in your head.
All right.
You ready?
Yep.
All right. Number one, virtually all of South America is east of Florida. Item number two, the entire UK, that's the United Kingdom, you know, which is England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. The entire UK is north of the northernmost point in the continental US. And item number three, Spain is larger than Alaska. Evan, since you're our geography expert, you go first.
Oh, gosh. The map of the mind. I must unfold it and take it out of the glove box. And so virtually all of South America is east of Florida. All right. So in the map of the mind, here's North America. You go down to Central America. It does start to take this turn towards the east. The land does. And it does the whole Panama hook, as I like to call it. And then eventually connects down to, what, Venezuela and South America. So the question is most of it east of Florida? I think it does. I think it comes back east enough that you'll see that probably 80% of the continent.
No, it's like, Evan, it's almost 100%. When I say virtually all, I mean almost 100%.
Like 98%, 99.44% of the continent.
It's, yeah, it's like, there's a bare, you know, like there might be an island or something that crosses over, but it's like virtually, if you look at it, the entire continent is east
right.
of Florida. Just to be clear, it's not 80%, it's like almost 100%. Yeah.
Okay, all right. All right, well, you could be working within some tight margins there, but I'm thinking that one's right. Number two, the entire United Kingdom is north of the northernmost point of the continental U.S., okay, so my latitudes, if they're right, I think the U.S.-Canadian border, maybe up even near Maine, is about 47 degrees north. And where's the southern part of England go? It goes at about, it's in the 50s, if I'm not mistaken. So I believe that one is correct. Now, Spain, larger than Alaska. I have a feeling that this one's going to be the fiction. Those are two places you don't usually compare necessarily on a map, but Alaska is big. We underestimate sometimes how big Alaska actually is. I know it's about 2.5 times the size of Texas. And if I can do a comparison of Texas maybe to Spain, that's kind of what puts it over the edge for me. So I'm going to say that Spain is not larger than Alaska, that's the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see. So South America and Florida, yeah, it sounds close enough. Entire UK is north of the northernmost point. That sounds okay. And then I was thinking weather. Like, wait, does that mean that the UK is equivalent to Canada? And but then I'm thinking that it gets the
Gulf Stream,
the flow of warm water towards that area. Well, I mean, a lot of its weather is because of that flow of warm water that goes up there. So that definitely moderates the weather. So that sounds kind of right. The only one that sounds like really like what the hell is this third one? Spain larger than Alaska. I'm not buying that, but it seems too easy. I'm missing something here, but I'm going to say that's fiction as well.
And Jay.
All right. So the first one here, virtually all of South America is east of Florida. Yeah. I think this one is science. I mean, I remember reading something about Panama being south of Florida. And if that is the case, then that one does seem to make sense. Yeah, when you say virtually all, you know, if it's not all, it's damn close, I guess. The entire UK is north of the northernmost point of the continental US.
So basically, if you transpose it, the UK is in Canada.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because when you look at a globe, you're not seeing things next to each other. You're seeing things. You'd have to look at the lines of latitude, you know, to know. But I can tell you with 100% certainty that Spain is not larger than Alaska because Alaska is gigantic. My Ooh. Family is planning on going nice. To Spain this summer. Yeah, we're taking the kids. Yes, got to travel while we can, you know what I mean? So I have been spending quite a bit of time looking at maps of Spain. And I'm actually familiar with geography in that part of the world pretty well. And yeah, it can't be because Alaska is virtually huge. It is just, it's a huge landmass that is no way there's anything in Europe that comes close. I guess that means that the entire UK is north of the northernmost point in the continental US is science, because I'm definitely putting my chip down on the Spain one as the fake. There you go, Steve.
Hmm. All right. So you guys are all agreeing. So let's take these in order, or at least we'll start with number one. Virtually all of South America is east of Florida. You guys all think this one is scientific geography. And this one is science.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. When you look at, because we think of South America as being south of North America, but it's actually as much east as it is south. It's entirely east of like the majority of the United States. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, again, completely east of Florida. There's really just, it's the tiniest sliver on the westernmost part of South America that just barely crosses over the longitude line that is, you know, to the east of Florida. It is deceiving, you know, because we do think of it as, we know it's to the right a little bit, but it's really a lot farther to the right than most of us have in our mental maps of the world. You know
mm-hmm,
what I mean?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So that one is surprising when you really look at it. Let's jump to number three.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Spain is larger than Alaska. So Let me say this.
I can't be wrong.
That you guys remember that the map grossly distorts.
Yes.
I meant to ask you about Mercator. Is it a Mercator projection or a Robinson projection?
Steve, that's Greenland.
There's no way that the map is distorting Alaska to the point. Alaska is gigantic.
Actually, Alaska would be more distorted than Spain, I would think, but I'm not sure exactly where Spain's situated in relation to Alaska.
No, that's the point. Alaska is more is distorted to look a lot bigger than it actually. It's like Greenland. It's like as far
yeah,
north as
Greenland Spain. Never appears correct, or hardly ever.
Greenland is nowhere near as big appearing as it is big
oh
as it
God,
appears
it's,
on
it's,
the map.
It's,
right?
It's insanely distorted.
So there is a website. Insane. There is a website. The True Size. TheTrueSize.com. So you can take any country, right, and then pick it up and move it around the world and
watch it get distorted.
Awesome. Yes, and superimpose cool. it over any other country.
I love programs like
right.
that.
That's cool.
So, like, if you pick up Ethiopia, you know, which is near the equator, and you move it over Greenland, like the distortion effect completely changes your sense of how big each is in relation to each other. So, if you pick up Spain and move it over Alaska, it looks completely different than it does on the actual map.
Sure.
But Alaska is still a little bit bigger than
okay.
Spain. But it's not by as much as you think.
Okay.
It's not by as much as you think. You know, when you look at Alaska and Spain on the map the way it usually is, you know, Spain is about, when you pick up Spain and move it over to Alaska, it gets about twice the size that it normally appears. And it gets to...
Sure.
In some dimensions, it is, you know, it is like east to west, it's as big as Alaska, but it's not quite as big north to south. So it is really, really...
Did you go with square kilometer as the measurement ultimately, Steve? Or what did you use?
Either way.
Either way. Oh.
You know, if you look it up in miles or in square kilometers, or if you just look at it, you know, on this... When you can make a one-to-one comparison without, you know, eliminating the distortion.
I mean, Alaska's got a lot of... islands among, you know, the Aleutians yeah. and others, so you got to take
yeah,
all that into account as well.
Yeah, absolutely. All this means that this was the most surprising to me. The entire UK is north of the northernmost point on the continental US. That so the UK is basically in Canada. Like, we think of Canada
yeah.
as being very
yeah,
cold,
the Great White North.
To, you know, and you're right, Bob. The Europe is a lot warmer because of the currents, you know.
For the moment.
Oh, yeah. If they lost that current, it's not impossible.
It would
be like Iceland.
It would be like Canada.
It would. Yep. It would yeah. get cold fast.
Yeah. 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 The other one, I didn't add this because I didn't want to, you know, have a fourth one. But do you think that more of the landmass of Africa is north of the equator or south of the equator?
I think north.
North.
Yeah, it's more north.
That big bulge.
Yeah, because of the big bulge. But I think we tend to think of Africa as a southern hemisphere continent, But actually, the majority of it is north of north of the equator.
Wow.
Yeah, and very little of South America is north of the equator. Very little.
Yeah, very little. Right. Just like Venezuela and Colombia and a little bit of Brazil.
So we project a little bit of that onto Africa, trying to pull it further south than it actually is.
So, yeah, so South America is farther east than you think it is, and Africa is further north than you think it is.
Yeah.
And everything to that's far north of the equator is not as big as
I love geography. Please don't hold the whales things against me. I have map collections. I collect globes. I'm a mapophile.
But all right, so good job, guys. So you know enough geography to get that segment correct. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
All right, here we go. What is a master but a master student? And if that's true, then there's a responsibility on you to keep getting better and to explore avenues of your profession. That was expressed by Neil Peart, drummer for Rush, who passed away last week. Died of brain cancer, glioblastoma. He was fighting it for 3.5 years, basically right at the time that he retired from drumming for Rush was when he came, when he got the news that he was dealing with this. So,
yeah
just super sad. I won't go deep into it. Certainly the band Rush for me growing up had such an enormous influence, as I know it has on many SGU listeners, because I've talked to them about it, even while Neil was alive. But now in his death, the outpouring on the internet has just been, unbelievable. Just so many people commenting and people writing about it and needing to express how much this person meant as a musician, a lyricist, and so many other things. And he was a humanist. He was pro-science, wrote all about technology, advancement of science, and philosophy. He was very well-read. I can't suggest the band highly enough or the writings of Neil Peart highly enough. You should go check him out.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Anytime, brother.
Thank you, Doc.
Hey, man.
Yeah, it was a fun episode. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.